I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Going Clear, Alex Gibney's critical documentary about Scientology, aired on Sunday night on HBO. This was on the heels of The Jinx, the shocking documentary about Robert Durst that led to his arrest for murder. He appeared to admit his guilt for three murders on a hot mic that aired at the end of the last segment of the series. This past winter, the podcast Serial, hosted by Sarah Koenig, also about a murder, was wildly popular and has led to an investigation into that crime. Today, we discuss what appears to be a growing interest in documentaries and the sometimes blurry lines between real life, journalism, entertainment, and the law. Our guest Joe Berlinger is a documentary filmmaker whose Paradise Lost trilogy chronicled the arrest and conviction of three young men for the 1993 murders of three young boys in Arkansas. Berlinger became convinced of the men's innocence and worked for their release. They were freed after serving almost 20 years in prison in a plea deal. His other films include Brother's Keeper, Some Kind of Monster, Crude, and Whitey. Joe Berlinger, great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Good, good. I'm actually on my college tour with my daughter, so.
I know. We're going to keep our fingers crossed so we can hold you for most of the hour. Let me introduce our other guest. Jane Kirtley is the Silha Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. She's also director of the Silha Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law. And Jane Kirtley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Joe, let me begin with you, only because you've been doing documentaries for such a long time. And it seemed to be back in the days that documentaries were sort of like soggy vegetables, good for you, but not particularly appetizing. Why do you think they are more popular today?
Well, I think it's part of a continuum. I think since Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line, you know, I remember sitting in a movie theater as a young person wanting to get into the movie business, watching, that movie with a Miramax logo in a movie theater saying, oh, my God, documentaries don't have to be just a spoonful of castor oil. And I think with that, with, Roger and Me in 91, and I think Brother's Keeper in 92 also helped, and Hoop Dreams. I mean, I think this is a second golden era of documentary. So I think, for the last 20 years, they have been gaining in popularity. And I think there's a lot of reasons for it. I think there's a technological reason for it, which is that, the democratization of filmmaking basically has allowed a lot more people to get into the game and a lot more stories to be told. I think which in turn has led to a huge diversity in terms of technique, fictional technique borrowing from documentary technique borrowing from fictional. So I just think there's just been this conversation between filmmakers in terms of the vocabulary of filmmaking that has greatly expanded the form. I think, of course, reality television has whetted people's appetites for reality, and that is partially economic because reality TV is infinitely less expensive to produce than scripted drama. So I think there's a whole host of reasons, but I would agree with you that there's never been more opportunity for documentary makers than there is today. There just seems to be a huge appetite. And in part, that's driven by, it used to be the theatrical documentary was the gold standard. I think that is on the wane, but it's been replaced by tremendous possibilities in with digital platforms in really growing how people can consume documentaries. So I just think all these things are coming together to make it, never more popular in terms of the form.
And I want to get back to all of that. Let me get you in on the conversation, Jane. Do you also think there is a kind of hole, if I can put it that way, in journalism, in that there aren't the numbers of journalists who are working, there isn't the kind of long-form investigative journalism that we might associate, for instance, with Watergate? Is there a hole that's being filled by some of these documentaries?
Yes and no. I think that in some respects it's absolutely true that the kind of long-form journalism, video journalism, digital journalism that some of us grew up with is kind of gone the way of the dodo because of lack of staff, lack of money, and frankly, lack of conviction, I think, to move forward with it. On the other hand, this whole concept of the documentary / docudrama, which I think sometimes the lines between those two become blurred, raises, to me, some significant questions about whether what we're doing is, news in the classic sense, whether it is basically inspired by real events, you know, like the old made-for-TV movies, or whether it really is just a fictionalized version of something that, it bears very little resemblance to reality. And my concern about that is that I'm not always sure that the viewer is discerning enough to be able to tell the difference, not because they're ignorant, but because it's sometimes difficult to tell by the way these things are packaged, whether they're intended to be sort of a straight shot, independent analysis, or whether they're either being presented with a viewpoint, which, again, I have no issue with you having a viewpoint, but I do think that people need to understand that that's what they're getting, and it's not traditional independent news.
You're saying whatever it is, and I do want to talk about what it is, it's certainly storytelling, but you're saying it's not journalism, it doesn't abide by the same kinds of rules that journalism does?
It may not. It depends, obviously. I mean, there are still documentaries being produced that I think, would fit the kind of classic example of, See It Now back in the 1950s and 60s or something like that. But I think just we were talking about Going Clear, and one of the things that struck me when I was watching Going Clear, and not unique to this, is that they use recreations. You know, they basically shoot footage that is designed to look real, and it's mixed in with vintage footage that is real, as well as live interviews, live-at-the-time interviews. And I'm not sure it's necessarily clear to the viewer what has been recreated and what's original. So in that sense, one of the basic rules in journalism is that you're not supposed to be deceiving your viewer or your reader, and if you are going to do a recreation, you need to be really clear about that. Some documentaries just aren't.
Well, let me go back to you, Joe. I mean, do you see yourself as a journalist? You've done a number of documentaries. Do you see yourself as sort of operating under the same rules of journalism, or do you see yourself as a documentary filmmaker with your own set of rules?
Oh, that's a good and complicated question. And before I answer it, I do want to say that I do actually think that a lot of the, first of all, documentaries come in all shapes and sizes, and there's different ways of making films and different ones that cross certain lines and others that don't. But generally speaking, I do think because of cutbacks in investigative news and because, frankly, a lot of television now, and so the networks are owned by a handful of corporations, there are certain stories that networks won't touch. For example, I made a film called Crude about pollution in the Amazon, and I was told by a number of networks when I was trying to raise money for that movie that, that would offend certain advertisers and they wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. And so I raised money for that independently. So I do think that certain documentary makers are doing the kind of social issue investigative work that used to be done by networks. Also, I wanted to say that I think, you can't just point to documentaries and say there's a blurring of the line. I think our entire society, news divisions as well, have blurred the lines between entertainment and reality, and that does concern me as well, but it's not just the domain of the documentarian. Since The Thin Blue Line, there have been recreations, and in fact, there have been recreations since the first major documentary. Robert Flaherty, The Nook of the North was, we are told there was a lot of recreations in that film. So there has been a general blurring of the line between entertainment and reality over the last two decades, which I think we should all be concerned about. And to answer your question, I consider myself, as many documentarians do, I'm a storyteller, I'm a journalist, and I think there's, when you have the intersection of cinema, I mean, there's basically three impulses that drive somebody, I think, to be a doctor, greatly generalized. I think there are three impulses that drive people to be documentarians. One is, you're a storyteller. You love cinema. You want to tell a story. Another impulse is journalism. You want to investigate an ill. You want to, try to bring change to the world. And then the third is, sometimes people come into it for pure advocacy reasons, where you are an advocate for a subject. And I think sometimes these three impulses are mutually exclusive to one another. In other words, if you're a strong advocate for a subject, I think that's sometimes in conflict with balance. You know, sometimes, and I think that's the way of certain documentaries today that concern me is a lack of balance, a lack of showing both sides and letting the viewer decide. You know, Paradise Lost, even though that subject advocated for the release of the West Memphis Three, 20% of the people who walked out of the original Paradise Lost thought the film was demonstrating that they were guilty because the kids were so strange in their opinion. And to me, that's a good result. You know, I want people to go off and see, you know, make their own decision about what they're seeing. So I think there's a lot of intersecting and conflicting issues and no easy answers here.
Well, Joe, let me just pick up on that. And my understanding is that from your first documentary about the West Memphis Three was that you went there to make a film about these three teenagers who were charged with this really horrible, grisly murder. They were into apparently satanic rituals, things like that. Once you began to talk to them and actually interview them, you came away thinking there was an excellent chance that they were innocent. So did you become, from, you know, the sort of straight documentary filmmaker to an advocate as you made this, as you made these movies?
Yeah, no, that's interesting and accurate. You know, we originally went down to Arkansas right after the arrests, 9 months before the trials, thinking that these kids were guilty because that's what all the press was reporting. And in fact, what HBO wanted, HBO commissioned the film, what HBO wanted was a film about teen satanic killers. And we wanted to go down and understand how three teenagers could be so disaffected from life that they would take 3 8-year-olds into the woods and sacrifice them to the devil. And so we went down thinking we were making that film, a bad teen film. And about 3 months into it, we started questioning the evidence, started questioning their guilt. But still, when we got into the editing room, we felt the best way to present the material was as, to show both sides and let the viewer decide, treat the audience member like a jury, which is a very specific kind of filmmaking. I mean, we're classic cinema verite filmmakers in the tradition of the Maisel brothers and Penny Baker and Wiseman, where we don't really tell the audience what to think. And so that first film was a pure cinema verite presentation of the year we spent in Arkansas, uncovering the story. And of course, our point of view is in the film, but it's not smashed over the viewer's head. And, you know, most people walked away from that film thinking, my God, these kids got railroaded. But some walked away thinking, they're weird. They must be guilty. And so to me, that's a good result and a good way to present the film. And we thought that that film was going to, you know, do for, you know, Thin Blue Line immediately produced a result for Randall Adams, who was on death row, who was the subject of Thin Blue Line. And we thought our film was going to, you know, bring these guys a new trial. And when it did not happen and they languished in prison, that's when I think we crossed from journalists into advocates. And the second and third films, I think, are actually much weaker films, and they are pure exercises in advocacy. And well, I think our balance kind of went out the window.
Well, that's interesting. Joe, hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break. Then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the popularity of documentaries today. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoway, and we are talking about the popularity of documentaries these days and the sometimes blurry line between real life film, journalism, entertainment, and the law. Our guests are Jane Kirtley, the Silhot Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. Also with us, and was just telling us about his Paradise Lost trilogy, is the documentary filmmaker Joe Berlinger. To join our conversation, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at @WHYY Radio Times. Jane, I want to pick up on something that Joe said right before the break, talking about his trilogy. Is that when he and his filmmakers became more advocates, were involved in the advocacy of these young men who were in prison, the less good he thought his films actually were. And I'd be curious about your response to that.
Well, you know, I think this is a topic that, long predates, modern documentary filmmaking. There's a wonderful movie called Call Northside 777 that is a docudrama, I guess we could say, because it's inspired by a real story that occurred in Chicago when a reporter was basically ordered by his editor to investigate into a guy who had been convicted of murder and was in prison, but whose mother insisted that he was innocent. And it documents how this reporter goes from skeptic to eventually advocate, going so far as to appearing before the pardon board to try to get this guy out of prison. And I use this as an exercise in my media ethics class to show my students that although this journalist used terrific reporting techniques in terms of getting access to public records and interviewing a lot of people and doing a lot of spade work, he gradually evolved from being a disinterested observer to somebody who was actively working to get this guy out of jail. Now, you know, I suppose reasonable people can differ about what the role of a journalist should be. But one definition would be we get the information, we lay it out there, and then we sit back and wait for the public and for government institutions to take action. We don't act as an advocate because advocacy means that you're losing your independence, that you're losing, for lack of a better term, your objectivity, although I don't think anybody is really objective. I know that Joe has had experience with this, and there have been other cases, too, where people that produce documentaries have found themselves being subpoenaed in the course of a trial, and the court may say, well, you know, I don't really think you're a journalist. I think what you're doing is essentially some species of public relations, so you shouldn't be protected by whatever journalistic privilege might exist. We successfully argued in a case in Wisconsin that the documentary filmmaker should be covered by the Wisconsin Reporters Shield Law, but that isn't the way it always plays out. We don't license journalists in this country, and anybody has a First Amendment right to engage in this kind of activity, and I absolutely support that. But I think the issue becomes, as we've been talking about all this hour, what's your role? Mm-hmm. Is your role to inform the public, or is it to advocate for a cause? They can work in tandem, of course, but ultimately, I think it's two different missions.
I do want to shift gears and actually go back to the jinx, the life and death of Robert Durst that has caused such a sensation, if I can put it that way. This is really the very end of the documentary series. We had to edit it a little bit. An edited excerpt of Robert Durst. He's muttering to himself. He apparently is not aware that his microphone is on. He's in a bathroom. And this is really from the final moments of this HBO series. I'll translate after we listen. I just want to give our listeners a chance to hear what Durst sounds like. And then I will tell you specifically what he says. Let's give it a listen.
There it is. You're caught. What the hell did I eat? Kill them all. Of course.
That's Robert Durst saying, there it is, you're caught. He's by himself in the bathroom. What the hell did I do? He moans, and then he ends by saying, killed them all, of course. And Jane, when I saw that, because I did watch The Jinx, it almost felt too good to be true.
Yes. And, you know, just as with the Serial podcast, I think there is often a question that is raised, and I raise it as a question, about whether this was, you know, set up to basically hoodwink the viewer, hoodwink the public, lead them down the garden path, you know, whether they were setting up this guy or whether it was staged. Those are the kinds of questions that in this era of, you know, assaults on media credibility from all sides, we don't really need to feed that particular narrative. And so I think that there were a lot of questions that arose, especially given the arrest of Mr. Durst and the questions that then came up about whether the people that produced The Jinx had actually been feeding information to the police as well. You know, again, I'm not making any accusations. I don't know what the reality is, but it does seem to me that when you don't appear to be acting independently but are acting in concert, that becomes a question about independence.
Joe, I'd be curious about your response to The Jinx and I guess how it was put together and whether you have questions about what the documentary filmmakers were doing and how much of it was, and it was very compelling. There's no getting around that. But whether, go ahead, Joe.
No, look, I think The Jinx was a triumph of storytelling and a triumph of television and a real watershed moment in documentary. You know, to me, it's the culmination. You know, a lot of people have been treating it like, oh, my God, this is this amazing moment, you know, out of context. But to me, it's just part of this longer continuum of this march we've had to this point of all fictional techniques borrowing from documentary and documentary techniques borrowing from fictional filmmaking. And, you know, on many, like, I haven't talked to Andrew. I greatly admire, you know, his previous work. I greatly admire this work. So I don't know what his decision-making process was. I find it hard to believe that that moment was, you know, recreated or faked. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think it's a legitimate moment. You know, the question it has raised for some is, you know, is it fair to use something that's on a hot mic like that, where the viewer, where the subject was not aware that he was being recorded? And to me, it's totally fair game. I mean, he was warned in previous previous episodes that his mic is hot. I know I warn my subjects that the mic is hot. You know, the question that nobody is asking is, was Durst playing with Jarecki, you know, in letting that be recorded? I have no idea. But I think it's a completely legitimate moment and a triumphant moment for documentary. That doesn't mean that a lot of these questions that have been raised about the manipulation of chronology, you know, that's a very important question that we need to ask ourselves in all documentary making, you know, which we can get into in a minute. And then sure. The other, you know, big question about that was, you know, that people should be asking is, how long was that in the possession of the filmmakers before alerting authorities? And the reason that's a legitimate question is that if you are, you know, in the possession of something that could bring a murderer off the streets, then you have a moral obligation to do that, in my opinion, you know, sooner rather than later, because if you're leaving a murderer on the streets, then there's potential for that person to kill again. You know, when we were making Paradise Lost, we were given a bloody knife, and that could have been potential evidence. And we had a great moral dilemma about whether we should turn that knife over to authorities, because we thought the turning of that knife over to authorities while we were shooting the first movie was going to shut down the movie, because the filmmaker subject relationship is a tricky one. And if we lost that trust, we felt it would destroy the movie. But we felt that good citizenship trumped any filmmaking need, and we had a moral obligation to turn over a piece of evidence.
And was that a significant piece of evidence that you turned over?
It ended up not being, but, you know, these kids have been stabbed with allegedly stabbed with a serrated knife, and we were given a knife, and when we opened it up, there was blood in the hinge.
Wow.
And so, you know, we just decided, you know, we had to turn it over. Even though we felt, you know, we were called back to New York by HBO. We sat around the table and discussed the pros and cons, and pretty quickly we all decided regardless of the health of the film, we had a duty as citizens to not withhold a piece of evidence. So I think that's the issue with the Jinx, is what did they know when, and how long do they hold on to that information? And I'm not casting any aspersions here. I have no information. I have no idea what their process is, and I greatly admire the work that they've done.
Indeed, I would agree with you on that. And to you, Jane, is that admissible in a court of law, what Durst said on this hot mic?
You know, I don't know the answer to that specifically. It depends in part on what jurisdiction they were in when it was audiotaped. In some states, it would be admissible after it was properly authenticated. In other states, unless Durst knew he was being recorded and consented to it, it would not be admissible. What's not clear, of course, is, as Joe was suggesting, is we don't really know what the deal was. I mean, did Durst realize that he always had a live mic, or should he at least have known that it was likely that he always had a live mic, and could that be construed as consent?
Well, and is this just plain old voyeurism, Jane? I mean, this interest in documentaries and perhaps even reality TV?
Well, you know, I think people have always longed for compelling stories, and crime stories have a tremendous appeal in our popular culture. You know, whether we're talking about Earl Stanley Gardner's, you know, Perry Mason novels in the 1930s and 40s, Dashiell Hammett, and film, movies, TV, I mean, this is not a new phenomenon. I think what adds, you know, the additional kind of shiver of recognition is the fact that these are real people in what purport to be real situations, and in some examples, such as certainly with serial, the podcast, the idea was you were watching the story or listening to the story unfold, which adds a tremendous amount of suspense. Again, very compelling narrative, way to approach a story, absolutely. But again, I would keep asking the questions, but is it journalism? We don't typically, as journalists, write our stories with the reader looking over our shoulder. As the story develops, we go back, we revise, we try to make sure that all of our ducks are in a row. And the fact that you're waiting to basically see what happens, or it appears that you're waiting to see what happens, changes that dynamic. And then if on the other hand, in fact, the author already knows what the outcome is, but it's just sort of playing with the viewer, that seems to me to be somewhat problematic unless everybody's in on the joke.
And that's Jane Kirtley. She's a professor, professor of media ethics and law at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. Also with us is documentary filmmaker Joe Berlinger, who in collaboration with Bruce Sanofsky has created such films as Paradise Lost. We've been talking about that. Brother's Keeper, Some Kind of Monster, Crude, and Whitey. And again, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We're talking about the popularity of documentaries, but also some of the questions they raise about things like real life and journalism and entertainment and the law. I do want to play an excerpt from Serial. This is the podcast in which the host and producer, Sarah Koenig, confesses that she, quote unquote, likes the subject of this true crime series, Adnan Syed. He has been convicted of killing a former girlfriend, Haemin Lee. Let's listen to this interchange.
Once, about 6 months after we'd begun our phone calls, Adnan asked me a little nervously, "What's your interest in this case, really? Why are you doing this?" And so I explained all the interesting stuff I'd read and the people I'd talked to, blah, blah, blah. But I also told him that really what hooked me most is him, just trying to figure out who is this person who says he didn't kill this girl, but is serving a life sentence for killing this girl. My interest in it, honestly, has been you. Like, you're a really nice guy. Like, I like talking to you, you know? So then it's kind of like this question of, well, what does that mean, you know?
I mean, you don't even really know me, though, Koenig. You don't. Maybe you do. Maybe. I mean, you know, I don't. We only talk on the phone. I don't understand what you mean. It's just weird to hear you say that because I don't even really know you.
But wait, are you saying you don't think that I know you at all?
I mean, for you to say that I'm a great person, I mean, like a nice person, you know what I'm saying? I don't know. Like, I've only talked to you on the phone a few times. I guess you investigated me back then.
Joe, I remember listening to Serial when I got to that. First of all, Sarah Koenig's sort of honesty of putting this on tape, the fact that she admitted that she really liked him, that he's a really nice guy. He's a guy who's in prison for murder. And then his response, this long pause, and he seems almost like caught off guard, and says, "You don't really know me." And as someone who has spent, you know, almost 20 years trying to get these three men, you know, out of prison in Arkansas, I'd just be curious about the kind of relationship that develops over time when you're so invested and so involved in someone's life like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and the filmmaker-subject relationship is such a – we could talk an hour or more,
yes,
or more
indeed.
On that. And you know, I mean, my favorite entry into that arena is Janet Malcolm's The Journalist and the Murderer, which anybody interested in journalism should read. That was a New Yorker article that was then published as a little book. You could read it in like an hour. There's very tricky issues. I mean, and The Journalist and the Murderer talks about, you know, ultimately the, you know, I mean, just to paraphrase, you basically, ultimately, there's a perception of friendship with your subject, but at the end of the day, in service of the truth, you have to, you know, sell out your subject, which I don't know if I totally buy that, but in some cases, it's true, and it's a very tricky relationship, and I can just give you an example from Paradise Lost where I still feel tremendous pain over what happened. And that is when we first went down to make the film, as we talked about, we thought we were making a film about guilty teenagers. And we got amazing access to all sides of the case because we told everybody we're here to, you know, we're here to tell the truth. But we in particular got access to the families of the victims who were in tremendous pain after having lost their 8-year-old children, telling them the truthful statement at the time that, you know, we're here to tell the story of these rotten teenagers so that it doesn't happen again. And we can understand why there's this phenomenon of teens killing teens. And so they let us into their lives, believing we were on their side. And somewhere down the road, we became convinced of the West Memphis Three's innocence as opposed to their guilt. And the healing process for victims of crime is knowing who did it and having that having finality in that. And so when our film came out, the parents of the victims were horrified that the film didn't confirm their guilt, and they hated our guts for a long time. And in fact, you know, two of the three families have come to agree with us and have become very, you know, good friends and understand that the wrong people were put in prison. But one of the families is still convinced that a bunch of Hollywood liberals, which is funny on many levels because I don't live in Hollywood, you know, far from it, and documentary is not Hollywood either, but this, you know, these families still believe that, you know, this was a journalistic hoax, and that these guys are guilty, and they continue to really hate us, and which to me is extremely painful because the last thing I want to do is cause more pain to families that have, you know, undergone such pain. And so it's a very tricky relationship, and, you know, it's the illusion of friendship, but it really isn't. I believe I'm there to serve the truth.
Well, let's take a very short, hold on to that thought. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with documentary filmmaker Joe Berlinger and with Jane Kirtley, and she is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about what could be described as the golden age of documentaries. Not only are some very compelling and groundbreaking ones being made, there appears to be a growing audience for these true stories. We've been talking about the Serial podcast, The Jinx on HBO, Going Clear, also talking with Joe Berlinger. Who's a documentary filmmaker. His Paradise Lost trilogy chronicled the conviction and court battles of three young men in Arkansas accused of the grisly murders of three young boys, and this is back in 1993. Also with us, Jane Kirtley, a professor of media ethics and the law at the University of Minnesota. We'd be curious about your reaction to what we've been talking about and to documentaries, whether it's the Serial documentary or some of these other TV or movie documentaries. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Jane, I thought it was just fascinating the way Joe was talking about the kind of regret that he had, going down to Arkansas thinking he was making one film and getting people to open up to him, and then realizing he was actually making another film and realizing that people had told him things that could be hurtful to them.
I think what his very candid comments underscore is that if you are approaching a topic in a neutral way, in a disinterested way, you don't really know where you're going to end up. You may have a concept, you may have a theory, but ultimately you don't know where you're going to end up. And so, you know, to state, I suppose, the obvious, you have to walk a very delicate line between being candid enough to be able to persuade people to talk to you, but on the other hand, not misrepresenting what it is that you're intending to do. I mean, there's just no excuse for misrepresentation in my judgment, and I'm certainly not saying that Joe did that. But I think that it is tempting, and the Janet Malcolm piece that he talked about, I think, weighs in a lot of people's minds, whether journalists that essentially befriend the subject of something that they're going to write about and then basically put the knife in their backs in the process are ethical. The short answer is that they're ethical if they've been up front from the very beginning. I think you owe the public, you owe journalism the truth, and the truth has to take you where it takes you. And if that means that you've hurt people along the way, that is something that, you know, shouldn't be dismissed lightly, but I would think it could be minimized to some extent by being as upfront as possible from the very beginning. I mean, I listened to that Serial clip as well, and I was thinking what was really interesting to me was sort of another aspect of it, which was the comment that, how can you know me? You've only spoken to me on the phone.
Yes.
One of the things that I think is so wonderful about documentaries is that we're still dealing with one-on-one relationships where people are actually talking to people face-to-face. Sadly, so many journalists today, and particularly young journalists, think, I can do my entire story just by email. It's not even a question of, will I talk to the person on the phone? I'm not going to meet them in person. I'm not going to talk to them on the phone. It can all be done by email. And when we lose that kind of ability to talk to and assess who it is that you're talking with, how can you possibly make a judgment about their credibility if you haven't had a chance to kind of lock eyes with them? It's a very, to me, unfortunate reality that has been created by the digital age, that you can cobble together a story without that kind of one-on-one relationship that certainly Joe has cultivated with the people he's written about and reported about.
And I do want to get to our callers. Joe, are you still surprised about what people will say on camera?
I think increasingly so. You know, I'm amazed where I've been able to take a camera. I think that's a particular societal issue we have, where just anybody, I shouldn't say anybody, but people increasingly want to, you know, be on camera, have their stories told, and it surprises me. And I just want to take a slight left turn, because there's one issue that I think has been left out of this conversation and the larger conversation, and that is, to me, the subjectivity of most media. You know, I think we all pretend that there's this thing called journalism that's the absolute unassailable truth, and I think all media is incredibly subjective, documentary making included. And, you know, I can only give an example, like, I talked about this subject last week on NPR, which is, you know, the hallowed halls of radio journalism, you know, All Things Considered. I don't want to pick on All Things Considered, but, you know, I was pre-interviewed for a story. The correspondent obviously had a preconceived idea of what he wanted to say, and what actually ended up in that interview, you know, reflected very little of the points I was actually trying to make. So I think all media is very subjective, all shaped by the subjective considerations of the person presenting it. And I think truth and media is all incredibly subjective. So we shouldn't be surprised that there's subjectivity in documentary. That's not a license to manipulate chronology, to put words into people's mouths, to not, you know, stick to the facts. But I think there's a level of subjectivity in all journalism.
Well, and just picking up on that, Jane, and going to you, and then I do want to get some callers. I see comments coming in as well. I mean, we're live, so we're not editing anything that you and Joe are saying, but, you know, we pick and choose the subject matter that we want to do, and you can say that we have biases one way or another. Do you agree with Joe that there really isn't, that there is always subjectivity in media?
Well, to some extent, I would agree. As you said, just the decision to do a topic or not do a topic is, I suppose, a subjective judgment. But, you know, with all due respect, I think that we have seen shifts back and forth in terms of what the standards in the mainstream news media are over the last 70, 80 years. I mean, there was a time when highly subjective journalism was the norm. I mean, anybody who's ever watched the movie Citizen Kane knows how it used to be. We've shifted back after the Second World War to more of the model of so-called objectivity, which some people think is not obtainable, but it is based on, at the very least, as Joe said, balance, if not true objectivity. Now we seem, because of the proliferation of a variety of media outlets, to be catering more to the idea that you should be able to seek your sources of information that basically confirm what you already think.
Right.
And whether that's liberal or conservative or somewhere in the middle, people seek out those things that are going to basically reinforce the views they already have. That worries me a lot, because I think it's tremendously important that we force ourselves through serendipity, if not by design, to encounter ideas that challenge us. So I don't disagree with Joe's point in the abstract, but I would like to say that, to me, it's not good journalism unless it's very clear and transparent that you've got an agenda and that's what you're going to promote.
Let me see what Jeff from Langhorne has to say. Langhorne, PA. Jeff, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead, Jeff.
I was just wondering if your guests, if they've seen the movie Citizen Four, could comment about what they thought about it and also where they thought it fell on the spectrum between journalism and advocacy. And I'll take my responses off
the
air.
And this is Laura Poitras's Citizen Four. It got the Academy Award this year. Joe, did you see that documentary?
I did. I thought it was brilliant. And I should disclose I'm friends with Laura. So
okay, fair enough.
That's all I would say. You know, but no, I thought it was a brilliant portrait of, you know, but it's also she was making the news as well as being as well as covering it. So, you know, but I think there was it was an amazing moment of capturing something while it was happening and in a very important work. And I thought deserved the Academy Award.
What about for you, Jane?
I agreed in the sense that it was an absolutely riveting sort of fly on the wall kind of documentary because of the involvement that she had in terms of producing this and the threats and challenges that she faced. But to me, it clearly was something that had a point of view. Nothing wrong with that, but let's not pretend that it was an objective documentary. I don't think it was intended to be, and I don't think that it was.
What is an objective documentary? And I'm thinking about some current ones. There's the one about the Invisible War. This is about rape on U.S. military bases. The Central Park Five was about those teenagers falsely accused of a horrible rape in Central Park. Blackfish, the treatment of, you know, marine life at amusement parks. There's a new one about rape on college campuses. I'm curious, Jane, what would be a good example of an objective documentary?
Yeah, I was afraid you were going to ask me that question because here's the thing. I mean, one of the things that some people criticize journalism in general for, and I think you would include documentaries in this, is that they are by definition not objective because they are seeking to report on where something's gone wrong. I mean, they are going on the assumption that something's out of sync. You know, people are being murdered, people are being raped, waters are being polluted. I mean, whatever the case may be, there's no such thing as objectivity in that sense because you're basically trying to demonstrate and expose where the problems are as you see them. So from that perspective, I'm not sure that there is objectivity. I mean, I mentioned, you know, Edward R. Murrow's See It Now series back in the 1950s. I think a lot of people might have said that the kind of reporting that he and CBS was doing was not objective because what was it doing? It was exposing the fact that there was serious poverty in America, as an example. They would say it was objective. Other people might not. Again, I'm not trying to suggest that there was a golden age of documentaries, 100 years ago, and we're never going to achieve that again. I'm just saying that I think, by its very nature, if a documentary is intended to expose problems, people are going to say you're going in with a preset expectation, by definition, it cannot be objective.
Joey,
is the danger of the objectivity standard, of course, because you're basically suggesting that all points of view are of equal value.
Yes,
all allegations are equal, and of course, part of what journalists and documentarians do is try to test those and discern which ones are and which ones aren't.
Go ahead, Joe, and then we'll get back to our callers. Yep.
Look, this is where my whole subjectivity question comes in. I think documentary in particular are a very subjective media, and I think all media is subjective, as I said. But in documentary making, the angle of the shot you choose is a subjective decision, high angle, low angle. You know, for Paradise Lost, we shot probably 250 hours of material, and the film was ultimately 2 hours long. 2.5 hours long, lots of subjective decisions are being made about what to put in and what to take out. There's compression of time. You know, 3 weeks of a murder trial was compressed into an hour of screen time. Clearly, dialogue decisions are being made about what to leave in, what to leave out. It's very subjective, but hopefully what you're doing is presenting the emotional truth of a situation. And more importantly, and this is where I do fault some of my peers in the current crop of documentaries, you know, you do have to have balance. Subjectivity doesn't mean not having balance and not hearing from the other side. And in fact, over the years, my films have been criticized for not having a clear point of view. I mean, when Brothers Keeper first came out, people were confused because we didn't tell the audience whether or not we thought Delbert Ward was guilty. And my feeling was, you know, we're presenting both sides and letting the audience make a decision. And so, you know, I don't think pure objectivity is possible, but I do think balance and hearing from the other side. I mean, that's my, you know, I thought Going Clear was a fantastic film. I admire Alex Gibney, but I think that film would have been better if we had heard from the other side and let the viewer make up their mind.
Let me see what Nikki from Ballykinwood has to say. Nikki, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, Nikki.
Thank you so much for taking the call.
You're welcome.
This entire conversation reminds me so much of In Cold Blood with Truman Capote. And while that probably wasn't a documentary film or a documentary novel, it was supposed to be as true to life as possible. And what it did to him, his relationship with the accused, and the fact that he could never write again. And I'll take any response off air.
Sure.
Thank you.
Nikki, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jane, have you thought about that?
I have thought about that. And I think there have certainly been comparisons made to Truman Capote's book. And it reminds me of a discussion that I had many years ago, mid-1980s, when HBO had a docudrama called Murrow, which was about Edward R. Murrow. This long, long predated the George Clooney movie. And it was billed as a docudrama. And there were journalists who had known Paley, who had known Murrow, who complained that this docudrama basically made up things, put words in people's mouths, and yet to the reader or the viewer who didn't know the reality, that they would take this as the reality. And I think that's the issue when you do a novelization, for example, as Truman Capote did. I'm not suggesting it isn't a great book of literature, but I would say it's not journalism. And this is the problem, I think, when you try to merge these two things. I'm not talking about a narrative technique. I'm talking about, you know, flat out, you're going to fictionalize some of it for the purposes of basically making a more compelling story or to fill in some blanks. It may make a great and entertaining film, but it's not journalism.
Joe, we're almost out of time. I almost hate to ask you this at the end of the show. Do you think most documentary filmmakers are liberals?
Well, the guy who did the Obama 2016 documentary certainly isn't.
No, but whether he's the sort of lone outlier.
I think most people who get into documentary get into it because they feel some passion for changing the world and curing a social ill. And I'm certainly not saying that that's not anti, you know, I'm certainly not saying that people who aren't liberal don't have those feelings, but you tend to find, you know, people who want to redress social ills more falling into that political camp. And I know that's a horrible generalization, but and I'm sure there's many exceptions to the rule.
Jane, do you have a thought about that before we have to say goodbye?
I think many journalists, by definition, would fall into that category if the definition of liberal is somebody who, as Joe says, wants to right wrongs and expose problems. I'm not saying that there's nobody on the other end of the political spectrum that wants to do that, but I think it does skew towards those that are characterized as liberal.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Joe Berlinger, I've been such a fan of your work. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And I hope you enjoy the rest of your college tour with your daughter.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. He's a documentary filmmaker. His probably most well-known trilogy is called Paradise Lost. Jane Kirtley, thank you so much for joining us as well on Radio Times.
Thank you.
She's a professor of media ethics and law at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota, director of the Silha Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.